Thank you for coming for coming out to hear this. The Face of Imperialism is a book about how to think about imperialism, and it's a desperate need. It's a desperate need. You can see it today. Our people are so utterly confused by what's happening in Libya. They're standing shoulder to shoulder with the CIA and the Pentagon and the White House on Libya. They're standing shoulder to shoulder with these White House and these guys on Syria and the like. And so I wanted to talk about how to think about it and how people have been thinking about it. I wrote a book years ago, called The Assassination of Julius Caesar. It was about the Roman Empire, and I got to read a lot of literature on empire, and it struck me that the literature on empire, both more recent and also that pertaining to ancient times, looked upon empires as rather favorably. It also occurred to me that was true about movies, too. Have you seen all those movies of the guys in togas and say, but Rome shall prevail. And we're all sitting there going, yeah, Rome. Oh, Rome. And Rome was a bunch of butchers and thieves and plunderers and the like. But the British Empire, you know, they were looked at pretty nicely. Now, despite that, sympathetic treatment accorded to empires, they were seen as things, forces that brought order to these squabbling backward tribes and all that, built roads, you know, and aqueducts and did this and trade and all that sort of thing. So empires were something that was supposed to be pretty good. Nevertheless, America didn't have an empire. That was something else I learned. You didn't talk about an American empire. Jefferson did, Washington did. In the early days, they talked about how we're going to build our own empire here in the Western Hemisphere and all that, and across the continent. But by the 1920s, 30s, 40s, all sorts of countries had empires. The British had an empire. The French had an empire. The Dutch in the East Indies had an empire. The Soviet Empire, the most sinister and relentless and horrible of all, of course. But America, we just had territories and possessions, and we would give them independence too. So that was very nice. So when I wrote my book in 1995, before the Roman book, before the Julius Caesar book, I wrote a book called Against Empire, and I meant the American Empire. People said, isn't that a bit much, an American Empire? I mean, we had a foreign policy. We didn't have an empire. But by 2000, with it less than 5 years later, there was a whole rack of books coming out, and everybody was using the word empire. Everybody was saying it's an American empire or U.S. empire. They were entitling their books with titles like Sorrows of Empire, Follies of Empire, Twilight of Empire, Empire of Illusions. One professor writing in Harvard Magazine, unequivocal about this country's force majeure role in the world. We were a force majeure, the great, the major force power. We, quote, we are militarily dominant around the world. Unapologetic about that. Didn't feel he had to explain that. He was stating it proudly. A political unit that has overwhelming superiority of military power and uses that power to influence the behavior of other states is called an empire. Our goal is not combating a rival, but maintaining our supreme imperial position and maintaining imperial order. Hello? I mean, who's this Colonel Blimp? Who's the... Where was this published in... Rupert Murdoch, Wall Street Journal? No, it was in Harvard Magazine. Well, what do you know? And then there was a whole crop of liberal publications. In fact, some of those titles I mentioned to you were liberal writers like like Chris Hedges, Chalmers Johnson, especially Chalmers Johnson. He led the charge on all of this. And the charge was to criticize the empire, but never criticize it in the way that it was really happening. Criticize the empire because the people who were building this empire, the people who owned most of the world, the people who destroyed whole countries and walked away fabulously rich, the people who developed new means of undermining any kind of independence anywhere in the world, these people were stupid. They weren't as smart as those of us stuck away at various universities who were writing these little books, like Chalmers Johnson. And so we got critical analyses of American policy, but the criticism was always about how confused our policymakers were. The liberal critics are never happier than when they can rock back on their heels and say how confused these leaders are. How stupid Ronald Reagan was, he misused words. How stupid George Bush was, he mispronounced words. And therefore that proves he didn't know what he was doing. And I did a little gathering of the adjectives they used from these various books I mentioned, and I have a whole fat footnote in here. I'm not going to read the citations of all the sources. But Chalmers Johnson's and those people, and this is what, and they talked about their critiques of U.S. empire characterized U.S. interventionist policies as, quote, these are all quoted words, reckless, misguided, inept, bumbling, insensitive, overreaching, self-deceptive, deluded, driven by false assumptions, and presuming a mandate from God. They were laden, this policy was laden with, quote, tragic mistakes, an imperial hubris. You see, it was hubris. That's what it was. Just that means arrogance. or they saw this as a mindless proclivity embedded in the American psyche or culture. Excuse me. Well, I want to argue, and I did argue in this book, and I think I showed it, that empire is not just something that's done because people are overambitious or misguided or inept, or they don't have your guidance, Chalmers Johnson, because you're so much smarter than all those guys are. I argued that the empire isn't for power, for power's sake. Oh, that's another critique. That was Johnson's critique, too. And that's a critique that they often make, which is that these people get intoxicated with power. They want to get more, and they want to extend American power this far, and then they want to extend it that far because they just are they just want power for power's sake. It's not power for power's sake. It's imperialism. The empire does imperialism. That's the process of empire. And imperialism is more than just aggrandizing for the sake of aggrandizing. Even back among the conquistadores back in the 16th century and 17th century, it was God and glory. That's the power, that's the glory. But then don't forget the most important of the three G's, which was what? Gold, yeah. God, glory, and gold. Excuse me. Put it in the correct order, would you guys?
God and no glory.
There are real material interests at stake. There are fortunes to be made many times over. Behind Colonel Blimp, there stood the East India Company and the Bank of England in India. Behind Teddy Roosevelt and the U.S. Marines, there stood the United Fruit Company and Wall Street. The intervention is intended to enrich the investors and keep the world safe for their system. For their system of investment, their system of expropriation, their system of trade, their system of misusing labor and the like. So that's what I say. Now, you don't have to take my word for it, because the rest of the book splendidly argues and demonstrates and shows you how that happens. Among the plundered populations, there used to be a term used. It was called the resource curse. In fact, the American Indians used to have a saying, if on your reservoir, that bleak, desolate reservoir they threw all your people on, the one that none of the farmers wanted to use or plunder, and there's nothing left on it, it's now your reservoir. If on that reservoir you're digging one day and you discover oil, stamp it down, bury it down, get gravel, sand, and smother it down. If there's oil on your reservoir, that's the end of your reservoir. It's not yours anymore. The white man will come in and say, oh, wait a minute, we got a little mistake here on the deed. This land really belongs to the such and such. That's called a resource curse. That is, you had nations that were relatively sparse in their resources going to places that were relatively rich. They went into Africa and they carved it up. Who carved up Africa? I'll tell you who. The French, the Portuguese, the Germans, the Italians, and most of all, the Brits. And you can talk about Asia, the same gang, the same group, and Latin America, the same. There you got to put the Americans in, the U.S. They went to these places because these nations, these continents are rich. You don't go to poor countries, you go to rich countries. And you go in there, and I love to always list some of these things. I never get a complete list. But here's what you do. You go in there and I'll read this thing. For centuries, the ruling interests in Western Europe, and later on North America and Japan, laid claim to most of planet Earth, including the labor of indigenous peoples as workers or slaves. Their incomes through colonial taxation or debt control or other means, their markets, and the abundant treasures of their lands. And what were the abundant treasures? Gold, silver, diamonds, slaves, copper, rum, molasses, hemp, flax, ebony, timber, sugar, fruits. You don't want to have me mention every fruit, you know. Tobacco, palm oil, ivory, iron, tin, nickel, coal, cotton, corn, and more recently, uranium, manganese, titanium, bauxite, oil. Let's say that one again, oil. So this is what it was all about. That was the resource curse, that if your land was rich, God pity you, because the plunderers would come in and they would impoverish you. And the other thing they would do, the other thing that empires do, the other thing that imperialism does, which is never mentioned, by the way, in much of literature, is that they kill enormous numbers of people. I mean, they kill hundreds of thousands. They kill millions. Mike Davis has a book called The Victorian Holocaust. He talks about the millions who were killed by British imperialism and European imperialism. Many parts of the world. We saw that in our lifetime. Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam. A million and a half Vietnamese killed. 185,000 South Vietnamese soldiers. 924,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers. 415,000 additional civilians. Probably higher than that. They're less likely to get a count. And 58,000 American troops. So killing is a really big part of it. So the face of imperialism reveals an endless carnage and an endless slaughter, parading under the flag of humanitarian intervention, or protecting the rights of a minority ethnic group in the area. Or, as George Herbert Walker Bush, when he went to Somalia, to help them with their famine. I mean, wasn't that a funny one? George Herbert Walker Bush, skull and bones, Yale, CIA, U.S. Navy, Vice President, Senate, U.S. Senator, Vice President, then President of the United States, concerned about famine in Somalia. There was a famine going on that very year in about 11 African countries. He didn't show the slightest interest in any one of those countries. But Somalia, he went in where they had just done all this prospecting and said 3/4 of this country has oil under it, rich oil reserves. And suddenly, George Herbert Walker Bush was moved in his heart to go into Mogadishu and kill a lot of people to set them straight, because they weren't, didn't understand this was a humanitarian mission. How do you make these people understand? You just level the guns at them when they start getting too close. So this is the dominant paradigm. And these kinds of interventions are the carnage is never mentioned. Instead, we got to keep in mind these are the terms that are used when you go to college and when you go to graduate school and the like. These are the terms that are used to describe all this: foreign policy, international relations, overseas commitments, regime change, and intervention. And that's the way it is. Do the people who put forth the lies of empire, do they believe what they tell us? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes they sincerely think they're doing a good thing, like they're stopping communism and that's better for everybody in life. And sometimes you could see they are in the most hypocritical contradictions. And I deal with any number of them in the book. Now, it's not only resource acquisition. It's not only going into these countries for the oil and the cotton and the iron and this and that and the other thing. Ronald Reagan went into Grenada. Remember? The little island of Grenada. 102,000 people he sent a force in and invaded and took over Grenada. It was in the hands of a revolutionary movement that was now communalizing the land, setting up farm communes, public health programs, and all sorts of things. That had to be stopped. Ronald Reagan went in and he said, this intervention is not about nutmeg. You know, he was a very smart guy. As the liberals all rocked back on their heels and chuckled about how stupid Ronald Reagan is and how stupid American foreign policy is. We always get in, we always back the wrong guys. Why are we always backing the wrong guys? Because you're stupid to never ask the question, what makes you think they're the wrong guys for the guys up there at the top? Maybe they're the right guys. Maybe you should start opening your mind a little more critically. And Ronald Reagan was hinting at something really at the heart of the matter. It wasn't a resource allocation. We didn't need Grenadian nutmeg. We can get perfectly good nutmeg from Africa, for God's sake. And anyway, what, Grenada's going to bring us to our knees by cutting off our nutmeg supply? He said that. He was absolutely right. What he was doing was serving notice to every nation in the Caribbean that if you chart this revolutionary course like the New Jewel Movement did in Grenada, this is what's going to happen to you. We are going to come down on your neck and we will put you straight. And those communal farms have been reconverted to golf courses in Grenada. And the tourist industry is back and the poverty is back even more. The same with Panama under Noriega. We will show you, you try to change this, you try to open up opportunities, you try to expand your middle class, you try to lift your wage earnings, you try to increase your social wage, you try to expand your social services, you do those kind of things, you try to turn this into a social democracy instead of a cheap third world country that's open to us, that we can mess you over any way we want. You try to get out of that rope and we will come down on you so hard. And you'll never forget it. And if we have to kill 20,000 of you, or 50,000, or 80,000, we're prepared to do it. You got the message? Capiche? You understand? And that's the issue. That's what's going on. That's what's happening in Libya right now. They're being told that you are out of line. It's not that oil. The French companies can get that oil. The Italian companies, the U.S. companies even could get that oil. But in fact, it's to keep these countries in line. The empire has only two kinds of countries beyond its border. The empire sees only two kinds. One are satellites, vassal states that obey, that throw themselves open to the U.S. And the other are enemies or potential enemies. Any sign of independence, any sign of self-development, any sign of self-preference is taken as a sign of developing a regional power. The American people can't get frightened. You can't frighten them by saying, Iraq may really take us down. But you can say, Iraq is developing as a regional power. So, in other words, they'll take this whole region and turn it against us. You may not get any gas for your cars or fuel for your houses anymore. You never know. And meanwhile, those countries are all begging to sell to the American market. There isn't a country. Cuba with its sugar, Iraq with its oil. They're all begging to sell and get into the American market. In fact, the Gulf War of 91, the Gulf War was about Saddam Hussein wanting a larger quota of the market, wanting to sell oil. And I saw it right in the Washington Post business section. Iraqi oil may jeopardize prices. In other words, too much oil may come in, too much. And George Herbert Walker Bush was saying no. And Osama, Saddam Hussein was saying there are different forms of aggression. There are different forms of aggression, and we are being faced by this. We're getting cut off, and we have no market for our top quality crude. So that's what it's about. It's not only about resource acquisition, it's about keeping the entire globe safe. It's about taking any country that wants to use its land, labor, natural resources, and its capital for its own self-development and targeting that country and seeing that as an act of anti-Americanism. Cesar Chavez is hostile toward America. Noriega is hostile toward America. And what these leaders are doing is they again and again, each one of them again and again, make overtures. Milosevic made overtures. He gave away the store at Daytona to avoid war in Yugoslavia. Saddam Hussein tried to avoid war and the like. They used some phony arguments about, weapons of mass destruction hidden away somewhere. So that's what this book is about and deals with. The empire just grows indefinitely and just keeps going. So I also have a chapter in here about free market servitude. I have a chapter about globalization and a critique of Marxist writers. There are any number of Marxist writers, and I never critique Marxist writers. I never want to get in on the sectarian. It's like the what's the term I'm thinking about in religion? The what?
Schisms?
No. Yeah, this guy. Schisms.
Where is secular Marxism?
Heretics.
The theological squabbles, the splitting, the one-upsmanship, the splitting, the, you know, how many Marxists can you count on the head of a surplus value, you know, and all that, get into listening. I don't waste my time with those guys. I do not want to talk about it. But they were going on globalization, and it was crazy. It was absurd. You can read it here. It's just a section of a chapter. The section is called Some Confused Marxists. I mean, they're absolutely confused. It kept saying, what's all this fuss about globalization? They didn't understand what the battle was about. And they all quoted the Communist Manifesto about Marx's favorite statement about capitalism goes into every corner of the world and remakes it in its own image. That globalization process has been going on all along. They didn't really understand what globalization really has become an issue. The kids out in the street who were fighting it in Seattle, I was with them. I remember being out in the street those days. It was a great time. And fighting in where? Prague and in Torino and in where else? All over Europe. They understood what it was about. Globalization was the elevating of the property right above all other rights. All regulations, all tariffs, all protections for communal production, all of that was overruled and wiped away by these global treaties. And I talk about it and how these Marxist guys, they would write these articles, all of them saying the exact same thing, and never once looking at the World Trade Organization, GATT, and all the other things that were actually happening. And see, it's like my theory's got this covered, so what do we have to worry about? And the trouble with some of those theorists is what? They don't know a goddamn thing about public policy. It's amazing sometimes when they come and say, and they're all excited by something that's so obvious to some of us who know public policy. You should always know public policy, and you should always know theory also, because your policy, your understanding of policy should have a theoretical base and show you to be able to parse and organize your empirical stuff. And otherwise, you just have hyperfactualism, and you don't know, then you're just some journalist who's turning out a half story here and a half story there. And if you have theory, your theory needs to be anchored in actual history and actual politics. Otherwise, it just becomes this armchair, self-referential kind of stuff, where you get into debates with other theorists, you know, secondary and tertiary interpretations and definitions of terms. So there's some of that in here. And the free market servitude, the following chapter after that one, I look at a country that is a perfect example of the perfect free market, and that's Indonesia. I mean, Indonesia is really close to what the Republican right-wing maniacs in this country are dreaming of. And it's really terrific. Indonesia, you know, back in early 60s under Sukarno, and the Indonesian Communist Party was part of it, they were building libraries and schools and hospitals. That's all gone. You go to Jakarta now, there's not a single playground in the whole city. Not a single playground. You got kids playing on garbage dumps. You've got 200 mosques and more being built all the time, but not a single playground. You got buses that go plunging off roads and breaking down. Almost every week a bus breakdown or a bus accident. Because the buses are part of the public transit system that's falling apart. Or some of them are private buses and they just scalp and squeeze as much as they can out of a passenger. You've got no hospital care to speak of. You've got no housing programs. It is a perfectly privatized country. It is carried out. Those who have money will get services. Those who don't have money will die young. And I cite him quite heavily too. Andrei Vlitchik. Andrei Vlitchik is originally Eastern European, but he's a brilliant analyst of Oceania and Pacifica and the whole Southeast Pacific and such. And he's done a lot of stuff on Indonesia and has lived there too. So that's a good source. He, in fact, has now, since this came out, he wrote a nice endorsement on the back for this book. He's writing a book on Indonesia now, which is good. I'm glad he is doing that. So that's what the book is about. That's what this book is about. It's a way to try to make you see certain things. It points out that capitalism works very well for the capitalists, not for people. It points out that capitalism doesn't work for humanity. And I can prove that to you in a few sentences. Capitalism is spreading all over the globe, and so is poverty. Capitalist Nigeria is getting poorer than ever. Capitalist Indonesia is getting poorer than ever. But the capitalists in Indonesia are very rich. They have small armies of maids and servants who they pay as subsistence slave wages, and they do very well. And you can go on. The poor people in the world are increasing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading. Now, what does Libya teach us? I mentioned Libya in this book, but I don't say that much about it, and because this book was in production and all before this this stuff started here. It came out in April. Libya shows us just what I've been trying to say. Libya's sin was that it had charted a different course. It had a leader, dictator, as everyone called him. Nobody in the West, by the way. Now you tell me, in the last 20 years, how many of you read and heard Mubarak of Egypt described as a dictator? He was always President Mubarak, wasn't that right?
Right.
That's right. President Mubarak. How many hear you describe the Saudi Arabian family as dictators? No. Saudi Arabia. Man, come on.
Oligarchy, right?
I mean, Libya is like Athens compared to Saudi Arabia. Yeah, it's run by the Saudi family with their Wahhabi fanatical Islamics who throw acid in a woman's face if it's uncovered and creepos like that. Okay, so what we had in Libya is an humanitarian intervention. I'll end it right here. And I hope, if you read this book, you could anticipate all of these things. Sponsored by the UN, which becomes aerial and ground war against the existing government and the people. Even when the government, and this is what happened in Yugoslavia, which is in the book, and Iraq, even when the government calls, and Libya too, it did it about the second month, calls for ceasefire and offers to negotiate, the attacks continue. Because the goal is really not to come to a negotiated settlement. The goal is to unsettle. And so they bombed Libya for 6 months, just as they bombed Yugoslavia for 2.5 months, almost 3 months, 2.5 months. The bombing is sponsored by the United Nations, not the bombing of Iraq or Yugoslavia. With Yugoslavia, China and Russia vetoed it. This time, China and Russia, not that close or friendly with Libya, just abstained. So the UN, but even with the UN going in, the attacks in each of these cases is not carried out by the UN, it's carried out by NATO. And behind NATO, it's carried out essentially by the US. And that means massive bombing, destruction of factories, utilities, ports, houses, hospitals, food supply depots, and the like. Drones, helicopter gunships, strafing civilians. The loss of life estimated 20, 30, 40 a day of Libyan civilians. Who were the civilians that the NATO forces were protecting? They came in to rescue them, but to save you, we had to blow you up and kill some of you. Pretenses and lies about atrocities. I remember in the first week somebody being interviewed, I think it was on Amy Goodman too, and he said, yes, 10,000 have been slaughtered by Gaddafi. What? 10,000? The fight had just begun. These small rebel groups were here. But somehow Gaddafi had gone out there and he had killed 10,000. Who? Where? What locales? For what motive? What were the disturbances that led him to do that? But these kind of things come up. What you do is you demonize the leader. You, whether it's a Milosevic or Noriega or Saddam Hussein, who was a butcher. Saddam Hussein was a killer and a murderer and a torturer. But when he was doing that, they loved him in Washington. They adored him. He was a staunch ally. They loved him. It's when he got out of line on the oil quotas. That's when they started. It's when he refused to privatize his economy. He kept it state-run, and he started training Iraqis in engineering and this and that and sending them abroad, men and women. It's when he kept some of the reforms that the previous Democratic government had had. Remember, it was a Democratic government back then. And when the U.S. went in and said, we're going to teach these poor little Iraqi Iraqis what democracy is, teach them how to do democracy, because they don't know. 5,000-year civilization, they don't know how to do democracy. The Americans, we know how to do democracy. Look at our democracy, right? Isn't it great? I mean, don't you feel good? I mean, it's the most expensive democracy in the world. We spend $20 billion every 4 years to elect a president. I mean, who wouldn't want to match that democracy? And then the role of the media, again, so predictable. Massive demonization of the leader gives license to bomb his people. But not concerned about democracy in Egypt. Not concerned about democracy in Saudi Arabia. See, this is, it's here. Let me go back to the first points of this talk. I'll be wrapping it up now. It's here that the liberal critics come in and say, you see how confused they are? They're going against Libya because it's not a democracy, but they're giving aid to Saudi Arabia and to the dictator Mubarak for 30 years in Egypt. How confused. They're not confused. You're confused, you stupid ass. They know which democratically elected presidents are theirs and which ones are not, that are really sincerely trying to make changes like Allende was doing and people like that. And those are the ones they target. And they know which dictators they like and support and work with and which ones they dislike. And so, and you can also see now death squads will be coming in, as in Kosovo and as in Iraq. The IMF and the World Bank, which Gaddafi kept out of Libya for 40 years, they're already getting ready to come in. Foreign oil companies are coming in, but that was going to happen anyway, because Gaddafi, in the last 7 or 8 years, he saw what happened to Iraq, and he started softening and making overtures and saying, okay, SAPs, you can bring them in. Structural adjustment programs, meaning cutting back on the social wage, letting private capital take over some of the oil companies and all that. He was beginning to, but not enough. Not enough. He was not a real vassal state. He was not leaving that thing wide open. He still had certain protections in there. And he also had abuses and the like, too. The goal is privatization, deregulate everything, everybody's poorer, everybody's weaker, wipe out the social wage, that is the social services and the communal needs that are there. The potentially enemy state becomes a vassal state. And that's some of the things, that's just some of the things that this book is about. I mean, was that an infomercial or wasn't it? Thank you very much. The empire feeds off the republic, and the empire replicates those social relations within the republic too. I mean, not only do you want to destroy the middle class and resource self-development and autonomy in those countries, you want to do the same thing in your own country too. You want a workforce that's hungry. The hungrier I can get you to be, the less choices you have, the harder I can work you for less and less. I mean, things were getting out of hand in America. That's what Jimmy Carter was told that by the business council. These guys came to him and said, what are you doing? You know, the inequality of income has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. We are going to end up as a social democracy. Imagine, these guys knew the term. I mean, there's only about 500 Americans who know what social democracy is, or even use the term. But these guys knew it, what it was. They meant we're not going to end up like Denmark and Sweden and that sort of thing. This stuff is countries which themselves are getting hit and being rolled back now, aren't they? But you've got to stop this. So the empire, the costs of empire are borne also by the people of the metropolitan nation, of the home nation. Now there is a lot of literature saying that the empire is in decline. It's losing and all. I don't see that. I see new bases being built, monster bases all over. I see the republic going into decline. I see the republic being starved for this empire. I see $400 billion a year to the empire is now more like $800, $900 billion a year under Obama, with Bush helping and then Obama. Is that what you're talking about? I mean, that there is this interplay of need and resource between empire and republic.
Right, and also that there are elements within those countries that, in fact, end up winning by our intervention there. our pawns, our peons, if you like, are the ones that help this intervention.
That's right. That's correct. In Indonesia, the rich Indonesians did very well with the American intervention that destroyed the Sukarno government and such. That's why the major unit of analysis is not nation state, it's class. Mm-hmm. It's what class is being served by whom. And that most definitely is something I should have included and made clear. I like when I said that the way the Germans went into Africa or the Italians went into Africa. I mean, it wasn't Germans and Italians. It was the ruling interests of these countries that went into plunder. I mean, my grandpa, he migrated to New York, to the United States. When I asked him why, he said, because I didn't want to die in Tripoli. That was the term he used. And I said, what do you mean, die in Tripoli? And he was saying the press gangs of the new Italian Republic. Now, this was 20 years before Mussolini, or about 14 years before. And they were taking these farm boys like him, farm workers, put them in the army to go kill people in Libya, in Tripoli. He says, I'm not going to go do that. So my grandpa was the draft dodger. That's a very honorable ancestry. And if he were here now, he would have liked to. Well, by now he probably would have gone to the bathroom. But anyway, I should make jokes. Okay, so it's not the people in now the common people get swept up in it because obviously no ruling class rules nakedly. It pumps up an ideology and. And the ordinary Cockney Brit will say, this is our empire, Britannia ruled the waves, and they sing the song as if they owned a piece of it instead of it was exploiting them, you know? That's called false consciousness. That's called when you're saluting the guys who are sticking it to you, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what they are doing right now. Yes, that gentleman then.
Okay, gotcha. Do you speak in this book or have any theories about, like, the psychology behind people who participate in, you know, an empire and help to build it, while there's, you know, people, there's rooms full of people who's like this one all over the world who see it as inherently wrong?
Well, I wrote a book called Super Patriotism and talked about how they get caught up. Some people, you know, learn a few equations and these things get hardwired in their brains very early. And one of them is to see love of country as a virtue. You see? Now, I see love of country as a virtue. Love of your community is always a nice thing, you know. But I said, loving what in my country? I have had a lot of fun in Super Patriotism to play with that. I mean, what exactly, when we say America is number one, I said, number one in what? Population? No, the Chinese got us beat, the Indians got us beat. Real estate? No, Russia has us beat, even Canada's got us beat. Even China is almost as, I think, an actual. What are we number one in? In cuisine? No, I wouldn't even go there. I wouldn't even bother with that one. And it turns out we're number one in material force. That's what it is. Wealth and concentration of wealth and material force. And that's it. But that's not what they're taught. They're taught that this is the greatest country in the world. We have things. A lot of those people aren't saying that as much now. You know, they just lost their mortgage, their house, and their job, and you don't see them waving the flag as fervently as they used to do it. You know, and I argued that. I didn't understand what loving your country means. I mean, what if I love the Piazza Ducale in Italy more than I love Rockefeller Center in New York? I'll bet everyone here would love Piazza Ducale in Italy than Rockefeller Center. What a dump. And does that make me less of an American or what? Self-hating American? Or, I was asked, I get asked on the radio, when I'm getting on these radio programs in the real Yahoo areas sometimes, back in the days in Vermont, I'd get on the station, guy would say, why do you hate your country? Do you, no, he said, do you love your country? I said, I love the people of all countries, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm especially attached to my country. In fact, most of my research is about American politics and American history. Yeah, I am more better informed and immersed in that, of course. So these people, they get wired up that love my country, and then the love of the country, which is an empty kind of but powerful emotion. It's empty of content, really. That's what I was trying to do in that opening chapter. Super patriotism is testing. What's the content of this? What exactly are you loving? You love all the American people? Come on, you hate this group, you hate that group, you hate the other group. Come on, give me a break. And then they connect that love with militarism. That militarism is a manifestation and proof of your love. Oh, he got both his legs blown off. He did this for his country so that we could go on loving our country, loving our Chinese restaurants, you know, which are our American institution. That's not such a joke. This guy, do you remember the guy who had the pizza place right on the Mexican border? And he was willing to take Mexican pesos instead of dollars. And these guys got up in Congress and started screaming at him that this American food is being pirated and they're using Mexican pesos instead of American dollars. It's an American dish. I said, wait a minute, pizza is an American dish? I happen to know otherwise, you know. So that's what I think. It's a very intense feeling, and it's at a very low level of development, really.
What about the people way up in power who like make the call to go and kill, you know, all these people to steal their resources?
They love their fortunes. That's what they love. Thomas Jefferson said it. He said, the merchant loves the country on which he's standing waiting for the ships to return, you know, for the sails or something like that. Something like that. Yeah, they so love America, they're taking all their investments off into other places offshore. No, I don't think they care about... They love their America, they love their country club, they love their kids' yacht club or whatever, this or that, the other thing. And I think it was that business council meeting. They said to him, Jimmy, you're going wrong. This is getting out of hand, they were saying. We got workers now, they want vacations. Now they don't want a week, they want 2 weeks. They want 3 weeks a year. Well, in Europe, they get 4 and 5 weeks. But they want 3 weeks vacation. They not only want vacation, they want paid vacation. Will it never stop? We'll end up in the poorhouse with these greedy workers just taking more and more. They want a minimum wage raise. They want this happening. They want that. There's no end to it. They want health benefits. Where the hell do they come from? Who the hell do they think? They don't want a population that's intelligent, that has a high sense of entitlement, that can organize itself. They want to cut back on your education. William Bennett, that reactionary, that guy who's always preaching to America about how to be virtuous, turned out he was a gambling addict himself, you know. And he said, too many people are going to college. I remember saying that a few years ago. I said, uh-oh. And sure enough, the way they're cutting back on loans, they're increasing tuition, they're making it harder and harder for people. They don't need you, they don't want you. That's not the model that they're really operating with. Now, they're not explicit about their model. They don't come out and say, we want a more depressed working force and a lower collective wage and the abolition of... they are saying that some of that about abolition of Medicare and Social Security and such. Or the president we have now is going to start cutting away at it, who's a republic as far as I know.
Deeper coming through history and partly through civilization.
Yeah. You're looking at the force. I mean, you're looking at the forces of traditional thought and conformist socialization. Yeah, we could go on all night with that. By the way, I have discussions in here on the dominant paradigm. Yes. About that, the dominant paradigm in terms of the U.S. and imperialism, and how to get people to think about that differently.
Corton or Bookchin relating to some of that, I think. Ecology of Freedom or Returning by Corton, perhaps. The Great Turning. Anyway, my other thing was, what do we do?
I know Mary Bookchin's work.
Yeah, he's good.
And I know Mary Bookchin. Yeah, he's all right.
Well, what do we do? Resistance or protesting on the streets? I mean, what do we do, you know, other than informing people?
Yeah, resistance and protesting on the streets and ideological development.
Yes.
That's what we don't have.
Yes.
You got a Republican Party that for 40 years have been hitting it home. And they've got narratives. They've got ideological descriptions and explanations. You watch Fox and every program there's fear injected into people. You're being oppressed by these elite progressives and and these people and us. There's a right wing populism that they have developed. They've won elections in places like Kansas, Oklahoma. They used to be populist. They used the populist idiom. And all those 40 years, the Democrats weren't doing a goddamn thing. Nothing. They still aren't doing anything. They're still just figuring out how they're going to win the election next year. Will you donate to me, please? And Obama's been disappointing and blah, blah. But there isn't. Where these guys, they've given people simple answers. We've got to do this because of that. We've got to do this. And these people get it, take it. It's an internalization of this instant socialization. And then they repeat it. They just repeat that. I call it the parrot syndrome. They hear these things on TV and then they internalize them and repeat them like it's their own opinions. And then they get hardwired around them, and then it's hard to shake them. But there are other people who really are trying to figure it out. Every day, I'm not kidding, I don't mean to sound immodest, but every day my email or Facebook or something, I get messages from people who say, gee, you really opened my eyes. I was so confused. I was wondering why this was going this way and all that. And so I think it's very important work when people say, oh, just sitting around together and talking is not going to do it. Man, ideas count, words count. That's why I was using these words and trying to tell you what were the forces behind those words. All of that really counts. It's not that the activism, save the whales, save this community here, stop fracking. It's true. They can create evils faster than we can even send out a mailing to start identifying these evils, and that's what they're doing. But we need that activism. I don't want to put anybody down who's involved in activism. You are the salt of the earth. But we also need to pause every so often and say, but why are they doing this? Who is doing this? Is it just this company? How could they possibly do this to people? What are the set of values? What are the implicit ideologies behind what they're doing? And what's our ideology? What's our goal? How do we want the resources of this society to be used? What do we want the U.S. federal budget to look like?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing, you see. Yes, Abby.
I was just going to say the widespread dismantling of services and the upward transfer of wealth is just an inherent system of capitalism. It's inherent within the system that we're living in.
For those of you back in the cheap seats, she said that it's inherent in the nature of capitalism that you're going to see this kind of misdistribution and this upward distribution and this continual accumulation at the top and deprivation at the bottom. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, but you know, that's one of the arguing points we should point out, that capitalism doesn't work for the most part. I wouldn't say for restaurants. Restaurants, I think they should be self-owned. That's okay. But aside from restaurants and maybe three or four other things, capitalism doesn't work. You really want to ride on trains that are run for the purpose of maximizing profits for the stockholders and the owners? That's what we get with Amtrak. And then it gets bailed out by socialism. And then the trains are running again and new cars are brought in and it's going better and all that. And then the stock is floated again on the market. It goes public again and people start buying it up. They make money on it and it's back again. It gets milked and stripped. And that's the way it is. We should point out that I'm for socialism because it works. I used to tell this to students at the State University. They said, socialism, how would that work? I don't know if I want to be in that. I said, you're already in that. You're at a state university. That's a socialist institution. Boom, boom, boom. What? What? Off-camera music. Boom, boom, boom. And you can see the panic in their eyes as they look for the door to run out. You know? I say, stay. It's not that bad, you see. I say, the faculty here is just as good as the faculty, in fact, better than some of the private schools. The students are better, in fact. you're learning. You see, it works. Socialism works. I had a socialist institution that I loved when I was a kid. Loved is too strong a word, but I liked it a lot. That was the public library. I didn't know in those days that it was a socialist institution. It was nobody made a profit. No money was ever exchanged by anybody. Any poor person could go in and get a card, and then you could read any of the books that you wanted to read, you know? And here I was living in a very poor neighborhood, and you know, when I would get tired of the pool room and the handball court and the street, I would go to the library and I would have a refuge there. Not because I was so given to ideas and intellectuality at 14, no, 15, but I was hungry to get a window, get a look into other worlds and other experiences that were beyond the confines of my present life. And it was a great refuge. Now I hear that Oakland is closing down. Of its 18 library branches, it's closing 14 of them. What is that going to do? Well, there's some kids who are going to really feel that, What do they got left except to go sit in front of the idiot television set still longer? So there's a case of socialism working. The libraries, there's a case. Public education, that for all its faults and all, it was better. It's better. There are communities that are fighting to get rid of their charter schools and get back to public education. What is a charter school? It's a school that privatizes all the work situations, lowers their wages, and makes sure there's a profit for the guy who is in the company that runs it, like a private prison and such. These are all, they're privatizing the military, all these special mercenary units. Instead of paying them $400 a week to kill people, they're giving them like $1,000 a day to go out and kill people. So socialism works better than capitalism. We try to use a counter-narrative. Part of the problem is we have limited resources. We don't own Fox. We don't have a television network. We don't have millions of people who we can reach. I get a book published, but it's in a small, even that, it's in a small publishing house. It's not, when Bill O'Reilly gets a book published, it gets a print of 200,000 copies, you know, and half of them are bought up by this group or that group to get his book on the bestseller list in the second week or something. So even on those levels, we're outgunned and all that. And yet, I would just say, well, you just don't give up. You just keep trying to do these things. You go in demonstrations. Yep. You sign letters. You make phone calls. Mm-hmm. You join organizations. You raise criticisms about these things, and that's the best you can do. You know, despite all their advantages, it's amazing. Sometimes the polls are quite amazing. Right now, 67% of American people say we want more attention paid to the social wage. They don't use that term. That's an old socialist term. But want more paid to social welfare, to what's the term?
Living wage.
No, it's not wage. It's not a wage. You know, human services. We want more, better human services. We want better things. That we want this mortgage scandal to be cleaned up so people can get their houses back. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about, oh, let's go kill some more Shiite or Sunni rebels or something. That's not what they're involved with. That's what our friends in the White House and the CIA are involved with. Well, let's go kill Gaddafi and all. You see people dancing in the streets in America because Gaddafi's been taken down, if he has been taken down? I don't see it. I think the right-wing Republicans are so intelligent. They're politically so smart. They know that they represent the interests of about 1% of the population, but they've got to hide that. They've got to. I heard Buckley and a few of his friends one time on a Sunday afternoon TV talk show about how we have to cultivate more interest in cultural issues to deflect the working class away. They forgot they were on public television, I guess. I don't know, but they were saying to deflect the working class away from from making pocketbook demands and that sort of thing, and get them, in other words, get them involved with what's the color of the skin of my neighbor going to be, rather than is he and I both going to be able to earn a decent living in the factory that we work in, you know. So play on racism, which has always been used, play on homophobia, you know. I mean, that same-sex marriage, that was throwing red meat at them. They were just probably had cheers of gratitude. Thank you so much. Now, yet another thing to distract voting constituencies for so long. I'm not putting it down. The right to marriage is a human right. It should belong to everybody and anybody. And as Will Durst said, remember, he said, you don't want homosexuals to have sex with each other. You think it's horrible and disgusting. Well, what better way to keep them having sex than let them get married, you know? And just, they organized. They developed conservative activists. They got these kids into the best law schools. They farmed them out and put them into clerking in the top law firms and courts. Before you know it, they were being appointed as federal judges at the appeals level and district level. And they consciously, you know, when Ronald Reagan started appointing judges, no Democrat had ever done this, ever done this, ever thought of it. Ronald Reagan took young judges. When he appointed these judges, and he had about 700 appointees, he took guys who were in their 30s and 40s and appointed them. Not in their 60s who would last 7 years, 8 years, 10 years. He put in guys who were going to be in there for the next 30, 40 years. We got one like Clarence Thomas. He's still with us. He's going to be going on for another 20 years. And they know to do that. Even the color that identifies their party, for Christ's sake. The Republican Party was always the blue party. When I was a kid, when Dwight Eisenhower beat Adlai Stevenson, you saw the map, all blue except for it was still a Democratic South, and that was in this pinkish red. And I remember that distinctly. The Republican Party was blue, the Democratic Party had red. And then the Republicans read some studies that said red was a more inciting and more commanding color than blue. They switched. And they got their party to be blue. So now we talk about the blue. There wasn't a single thing that they've left uncovered and such. Like, as I said, the age of judges that they appoint. And they appoint ideological right-wing judges to these positions. Not a guy who's like going to be an Earl Warren and turn around and have some liberal things, you know. So they know what the hell they're doing. That's my answer to your question. They know what they're doing. They had an agenda. They had the long march through the institutions. We talked about that. That was a Maoist phrase, a long march to power. The long march was, you know, part of the Chinese Revolution. And so we have to have a long march in the institutions. Well, they really did it. They really did it. And also part of it is that they have the resources to do it, whereas the Democrats don't have that money, don't have access to the media. Dennis Kucinich doesn't get that kind of coverage, you know. But Michelle Bachmann does get that kind of coverage. That darling, I love her. She's so nice. Yes, sir. They didn't mean quite what we mean today about it, though, I think.
We're going to Louisiana Purchase.
I wonder, is this what we're seeing is more or less almost an inevitable natural progression of what it is that we started with altogether, or is this sort of thing that's been going on here the last 50, 60 years, kind of an aberration, it's kind of a growth like a cancer?
What thing?
This push that ever further and further into this empire building.
Well, Washington and Jefferson were thinking of empire in terms of territoriality, of having more resources, more expansion for population and for strength. And it was called manifest destiny, that we, sooner or later, were going to reach the Pacific coast. And all it needed was a small little war in 1848 where we took more than 50% of Mexico. In fact, we're standing in it right now. This used to be Mexico. And we want English language, don't we? Only English language. San Pablo, Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all English language. Yeah, you know. So that's different. The empire today is global. The territory, the when an empire expands and gets a presence in an area, that makes that area now has to be defended, like any asset. It becomes an asset. And that means then that on the boundary of that area are new enemies that you have to watch for. So as the U.S. moves into Central Asia, in a way they never dreamed that they would ever be able to do back in 1990, just 20 years ago. When the U.S. moves into Central Asia, they then have to defend Kyrgyzstan. They then have to defend in Afghanistan or try to maintain their foothold or presence. For all the reasons that I just said, I'm not going to go through the whole talk again about resources and a particular kind of social order and all that sort of thing. But that leaves extended strength and power, but also extended vulnerability and extended stress. And the people back home eventually, you've got to wonder now, when are they going to say, well, you know, one war, two wars are okay, three wars, four, well, now you're bombing six countries. Maybe this is a little too much, you know. And that's when the liberals come in and said, we're overextending. You know, they're not overextending. They didn't do this because they're stupid or because they're, I don't want to repeat my whole talk, but because of the imperatives and the dynamics of it. So the perimeter, the patricians will bleed the center in order to expand and strengthen the perimeter. And the perimeter doesn't have a distinct territoriality anymore the way Manifest Destiny had. It could be, you know, today the Arctic, tomorrow South Africa, the next day Micronesia, who knows.